Zuga let it pass, and instead ran an appraising eye over the cart. It was the newest and strongest of the three vehicles he owned. One cart had gone with Louise St. John, and she had taken the best mules. But this rig would get them back to Cape Town, even under the additional burden that he was planning to put into it. Jan Cheroot ambled across to Zuga and took the other handle of the chest, ready to boost it up into the body of the cart. Wait, Zuga told him. That first. And he pointed to the roughly hewn block of blue mottled rock that lay below the camelthorn tree.
My mother, Jan Cheroot gaped. This I don't believe. In 22 years I've seen you do some stupid crazy things.
Zuga strode across to the block of blue ground that Ralph had brought up from the Devil's Own and put his foot on it. We'll hoist it up with the block and tackle, he glanced at the sturdy branch above his head, from which the sheave block and manila rope hung, and we'll back the cart up under it.
That's it,
Jan Cheroot sat down on the chest and folded his arms.
This time I refuse. Once before I broke my back for you, but that was when I was young and stupid.
Come on, Jan Cheroot, you're wasting time.
What do you want with that piece of ugly, bloody stone, with another piece of thundering nonsense?
I have lost the bird. I need a household god.
I have heard of someone putting up a monument to a brave man, or a great battle. But to put up a stone to stupidity,
Jan Cheroot mourned.
Back the cart up. I refuse. This time, I refuse. I won't do it. Not for anything, not for any price.
When we get it loaded, you can have a bottle of smoke all to yourself to celebrate. Jan Cheroot sighed and stood up.
That's my price.
He shook his head and came across to stand beside Zuga. He glared at the block of blue stone venomously.
But don't expect me to like it.
Zuga chuckled for the first time in weeks, and in an unusual display of affection, he put one arm around Jan Cheroot's shoulders.
Now that you have something to hate again, just think how happy it'll make you, he said.
You have been drinking, Zuga said, and Ralph tossed his hat into the corner and agreed.
Yes, I have had a beer or two.
He went to the black iron stove and warmed his hands.
I would have had more if I'd had the money.
I have been waiting for you, Zuga went on, and Ralph turned back to him truculently.
I give you every hour of my day, Papa. Let me have a little time at the end of it.
I have something of great importance to tell you,
Zuga nodded to the deal chair facing him. Sit down, Ralph. Zuga rubbed his eyes with forefinger and thumb as he collected his words. He had tried so often in the last days to find an easy way to tell Ralph that it was over, that they were destitute, that all that toil and heartbreak had been in vain. But there was no easy way. There were only the stark, hard words of reality. He dropped his hand and looked at his son, and then slowly and carefully he told him. And when he had finished, he waited for Ralph to speak. Ralph had not moved during the long recital, and now he stared at Zuga sternly. Zuga was forced to speak again.
We shall leave in the morning. Jan Cheroot and I have loaded the number 2 wagon, and we shall need all the mules, double team. It's a long haul.
Again he waited, but there was still no reaction.
You'll be wondering where we are going and what we shall do.
Well, once we get back to the Cape, we still have the Harkness cottage.
You gambled it all, Ralph spoke at last, without telling me.
You,
who are always preaching to me about gambling and honesty. Ralph, it wasn't yours. It belonged to all of us.
You are drunk, Zuga said flatly. All these years I have listened to your promises.
We shall go north, Ralph, he mimicked Zuga with a sudden savagery in his tone. It's all for all of us, Ralph. It's yours to share. There is a land waiting for us, Ralph. It'll be yours as well as mine, Ralph.
It's not over. I still have the concession. When we get back to Cape Town, you, not me.
Ralph's voice was flat, angry.
You go back to Cape Town. Go dream your old man's dreams. I'm sick of them.
You dare to use that tone to me, Yes, I dare, and by God, I'll dare more than that. I'll dare what you are too weak or afraid to dare, you insolent and stupid puppy. You toothless old dog.
Zuger threw himself half across the table, and his right arm lashed out. He caught Ralph open-handed across the face, and the crack of palm of flesh was stunning as a pistol shot. Ralph's head snapped back, and then slowly he brought it upright again.
That, he said, is the last time you will ever strike me. Ever.
He stood up and strode towards the door, and there he turned.
Go, dream your dreams. I will go live mine out.
Go then, said Zuger, and the scar on his cheek was glassy and white as ice.
Go, and be damned to you.
Remember, I took nothing with me, Papa, not even your blessing, said Ralph, and stepped out into the night.
Butzo woke instantly at the touch on his cheek, and reached for the assegai at his side, his eyes wide in the faint glow of the ashes. A hand closed on his wrist, holding his spear hand from the weapon, and a voice spoke softly above him.
Do you remember the road to Matabili Land, O Prince of Kumalo?
It took Butzo a moment to gather his wits from where sleep had scattered them.
I remember every running ford and every green hill, every sweet watering place along the way, he whispered back, as clearly as I remember my father's voice and my mother's laughter.
Roll up your sleeping mat, Butzo the Axe, and show me the road, said Ralph.
Diamond Lil did not smile so readily these days, not since the tooth that held the diamond had turned a dingy grey as the root died and began to ache until Lil wept with a little explosion of agony against the top of her skull. The travelling dentist from the Cape had pulled the tooth and drained the virulent abscess beneath it. Relief had been immediate, but had left a black gap in her smile. She had put on flesh also, the consequence of good food and those little nips of gin which bolstered her day. Her breasts, always generous, had lost their individual definition, and the cleavage that showed above the richly embroidered bodice was no longer a deeply sculptured crevasse, but a thin line where abundant flesh packed against flesh. The hand that held the bone china teacup was pudgy and dimpled over the knuckles. The rings that adorned each plump little finger had sunk into the flesh, but the diamonds and rubies and emeralds sparkled in a royal show of Lil's wealth. Her hair was still lustrous gold, and crimped into long dangling ringlets with the hot iron. Her skin was still smooth and rich as Devon cream, except around the eyes where it was just beginning to crack into little spider webs of lines. She sat at the corner of the veranda, on the second floor above the street, where the eaves of the roof were of intricate white wrought-iron mouldings, pretty as Madeira lace. Although there were other double-storied buildings in Kimberley these days, not even the offices of the Central Diamond Company across the wide unpaved streets boasted such affluent adornment. Lil's chair was high-backed and magnificently carved in dark red teak by Oriental craftsmen, inlaid with mother-of-pearl and ivory, and carried across the eastern oceans by the tall ships of the now long-departed Dutch East India Company. It had cost her £200, but from this throne she could watch every movement on the main thoroughfares that led into Market Square, could sense the pulse of the Diamond City, could check each coming and going, the scurry of a buyer with a good scent in his nostrils, the swagger of a digger who had turned up a bright one. She could watch the front of the four canteens around the square, all of which she now owned, and judge the volume of trade going through their doors. Similarly, she could glance to her left, down De Beers Road, to the red brick cottage behind its white picket fence and discreet sign. French dressmakers, haute couture, 6 continental seamstresses, specialities for individual tastes. Business was always brisk there. From noon to midnight, her girls seldom lasted the pace for more than 6 months or so, before taking the coach southward again, exhausted, but considerably richer. Lil herself worked her old trade only occasionally, perhaps once or twice a week, with a favoured regular, just for old time's sake. and because it got her blood going and made her sleep better at night. There was too much else that required her constant attention. Now she poured fresh tea from the rococo silver pot into the pretty bone china cups, hand-painted with pink roses and golden butterflies. "How many spoons?" she asked. Ralph sat on the cane-backed chair opposite her. He smelled of shaving soap and cheap eau de cologne. His chin shone with a burnish given it by the cutthroat razor, and his shirt was so crisply ironed and starched that it crackled at each movement. Lil studied him speculatively over the rim of her teacup. "Does the good major know your plans?" she asked quietly, and Ralph shook his head. Lil thought on that a while, and it gave her a ripple of pleasure to have the son of a foundation member of the Kimberley Club sitting on her veranda. Son of one of the Kimberley gentlemen who would not greet her on the street, who had returned her donation towards the new hospital, who had not even replied to her invitation to attend the stone-laying ceremony of her new building. Oh, the list of humiliations was too long to recite now. "Why did you not go to your father?" she asked instead. "My father is not a rich man," Ralph would not say any more. Too loyal to explain that Zugo was destitute, that he would soon leave Kimberley with a cartload of his meagre possessions. He did not want Lil to know that he and his father had turned from each other with harsh words. Lil studied his face for a moment, then picked up the handwritten sheet of cheap notepaper from the tea tray and glanced down the list and the figures. £900 for oxen. "A full span of the biggest and best animals," Ralph explained. "The road to the Shashi River is sandfelt, very heavy going. I want to be able to haul a full load, £8,000 weight."
"Trade goods? £15,000? She looked up at him again.
"Guns, powder, brandy, beads, and limbo cloth."
"What type of guns?"
"Tar muskets, £5, 10 shillings each."
Lil shook her head.
"They've seen the breech loaders. Your muskets won't have much pull."
"I can't afford breech loaders, and I wouldn't know where to find a load.
Ralph, dearie, I could hire a bunch of Whitechapel hags to run my dressmaker shop, and I could get them cheap, but I don't. I pick them young and fresh and pretty. If you think small, your profits are small. Don't be cheap, Ralph, darling. Never be cheap."
She poured a little gin from the silver flask into the empty teacup before she went on.
"I can get Martini Henry rifles, but they'll cost us 1,500 more.
Lil reached across and dipped her pen in the inkwell, then scratched out and rewrote the figure.
"Brandy?"
"Cape smoke in 20-gallon casks."
"I have heard that Lobengula likes Courvoisier cognac, and his sister Ninji drinks only Piper Heidsieck champagne."
"Another £500, at least," Ralph mourned.
"300, darling," Lil corrected the list. "I can get it at wholesale prices. Now, ammunition, 10,000 rounds?
"I'll need at least 1,000 for my own account, and the rest to trade with the rifles."
"If Lobengula gives you permission to hunt elephant," Lil corrected.
"My grandfather is one of his oldest friends. My auntie Robin and her husband have been at Kami River Mission for almost 20 years.
"Yes, I know that you have friends at court," Lil pursed her lips approvingly. "But I have heard that the elephant have been shot out across the whole of Matabele land."
"The herds have been driven into the fly belt on the Zambezi.
You cannot take horses into the fly, and hunting elephant on foot in the fly is not work for a white man."
"My father hunted on foot, and anyway, I cannot afford a horse."
"All right," she agreed reluctantly, and made a tick on the sheet.
They worked on for an hour longer, going down the list item by item, and then starting again at the head and going over it all once more. Lil ticking and scratching with the pen, fining it down by £10 here and 100 there, until at last she tossed the pen onto the tea tray and then poured a little more gin into her teacup and sipped it with a genteel flourish, her little finger raised, the spirit slurping softly through the gap in the front of her teeth.
"All right," she said again.
"Does that mean you'll lend me the money?"
"Yes."
"I don't know what to say." He leaned towards her, young and glowing and eager. Lil, I just don't.
Then don't say anything until you've heard my terms. She smiled thinly, without lifting her upper lip. 20% per annum interest on the loan.
20%? He gasped. In God's name, that's usury, Lily.
Exactly, she told him primly. But let me finish. 20% interest and half the profits.
And half, Lil?
That's not usury, that's highway robbery.
Right again, she agreed. At least you're bright enough to recognize it.
Can't we just... he started desperately. No, we cannot. Those are my terms.
And Ralph remembered Scipio, his falcon, with her beautiful pouting breast and fierce cold eyes.
I accept, he said.
And though she did not smile with her lips, her eyes were suddenly soft and merry.
Partners, she murmured, and placed her plump white hand on his forearm. His muscles were lean and sinewy, the skin brick-coloured from the sun. She stroked it slowly, sensually.
It only remains to seal our bargain, she told Ralph.
Come.
She slid her hand down his arm and twined her fingers into his. She led him through the stained glass doors, and when she drew the velvet-corded curtains, it was cool and dark in the room. She turned back to him and reached up to unbutton his shirt at the throat. He stood still while she worked her way down slowly to his belt buckle, and then she placed one hand, palm down, upon his naked right breast.
Ralph, her voice was a husky tremor, I want you to do something for me.
What is it?
He asked. And she stood on her tiptoes, placed her lips against his ear, and told him in a whisper. She felt him begin to pull back from under her hand.
Partners? She asked.
And he hesitated a moment longer, and then stooped and picked her up, one arm behind her knees, and carried her to the wide brass bed with the patchwork quilt.
You'll find it less arduous than hunting elephant on foot in the fly,
she told him, and it was dark enough in the room for her not to worry about the missing tooth. She lifted her arms above her head, opened her mouth, and chuckled in delicious anticipation.
The good thing about life, dearie, is that you can have whatever you want, just as long as you're willing to pay the price, she told him, still chuckling.
These are not bullocks, Butso told Ralph. Each one is the son of a snake mated with the ghost of a Mashona dog.
They were all strong oxen, big-boned, heavy in the shoulder, with wide, straight horns for strength, and even yellow teeth. Hand-picked by Butso, who was a Matabele and loved cattle, had lived with the great herd since he was old enough to toddle after the calves. However, Butso was not a trekman. He had never worked an 18-foot wagon with an 8,000-pound load aboard. He had never tried to put 24 trek oxen into the traces. The entire Matabele nation owned only a pair of wheeled vehicles, and those belonged to King Lobengula. To Butso, cattle were a store of wealth, a source of meat and milk. They were not draft animals. The closest that either he or Ralph had ever come to putting a team into the traces was working the little two-wheel gravel carts. Ralph had assumed that the oxen he had purchased were trained and amiable, but within minutes of his and Butso's first attempt to get them into the span, the animals sensed their incompetence and became as spooky and wild as hunted buffalo. It took 2 hours of wild chasing across the bleak grasslands beyond the town limits, 2 hours of running and cursing and whip-cracking to bring the bullocks together and get the yokes upon their necks. Half of them were badly winded by then and promptly lay down, and the others backed out and turned their great horned heads towards the load, tangling the trek chain and plunging the entire span into chaos. The excitement had brought out most of the loafers and idlers from the canteens on Market Square, though they had enough forethought to bring their bottles with them. They formed an appreciative and jovial audience, greeting each new effort by Butso and Ralph with delighted guffaws and facetious advice. Butso wiped the sweat from his face and chest and looked broodingly down the dusty road to town.
Soon Bakela will hear of this and come to see our disgrace, he said.